This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you're drinking bottled water, do you ever wonder where it comes from? Is it really from the spring that it's named after? Is it really just purified tap water from a municipal system? Is it worth lugging home gallons of bottled water when you can turn on the tap in your kitchen sink? My guest Peter Glick has written a new book called Bottled and Sold that answers a lot of questions about bottled water and also describes some of the problems it's causing. Glick says every second of every day in the U.S., 1,000 people buy and open a plastic bottle of commercially produced water, and every second of every day, 1,000 plastic bottles are thrown away. Bottled water may taste good, but Glick says it's producing billions of tons of carbon dioxide and other pollutants. He says Americans should be insisting that their municipal water systems are maintained and upgraded so that they can provide public tap water that is safe and tastes good. Glick is a water expert who was named a MacArthur Fellow in 2003. He's the co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute for Studies in Development, Environment, and Security, based in Oakland. Peter Glick, welcome back to Fresh Air. Most bottled water has such healthy-sounding names, like with springs and glaciers in the title, but the water isn't often isn't from a spring, or at least it isn't from the spring you'd think it was from. You give a few examples in your book, like Arctic spring water is actually from Lakeland, Florida. Glacier Mountain natural spring water is actually from New Jersey. Are they from springs?
Well, we get most of our bottled water in the United States from two kinds of places. We get them from springs, and if you actually see the word spring water on the bottle, it's required to come from either a spring or, more likely, from a groundwater well that's drilled into where that spring comes from. Or about 40 or 45% of our bottled water actually comes from reprocessed municipal water. That's a story all by itself. But there are a bunch of strange names for bottled water. We get Arctic water from Tennessee or from Florida, certainly not from the Arctic. Yosemite water comes from Los Angeles. Everest water comes from Texas. And there are plenty of big things in Texas, but Mount Everest isn't one of them. And so part of the challenge is thinking about what's on the bottle and what they're really trying to tell us versus what's actually likely to be in that bottle.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of bottled water actually comes from municipal water and is then purified and reprocessed. So examples of that kind of water, bottled water that's actually from municipal water supplies, includes Dasani, which is produced by Coke, Aquafina, which is produced by PepsiCo, and Pure Life, which is produced by Nestle. So when bottled water actually comes from the municipal water supply, how is it transformed into bottled water? What do they do with the tap water to the municipal water to make it bottled water?
Many bottlers, and some of the big ones like Coca-Cola and Pepsi that produce Dasani and Aquafina, they take municipal water. They often run it through additional processes, other filters, some kinds of purification systems. For Dasani, for example, for the Coca-Cola product, they actually strip out all of the minerals and then they put minerals back so that Dasani that's bottled in New York or Dasani that's bottled in Detroit or Dasani that's bottled in the San Francisco Bay Area actually all tastes the same. They call it pixie dust or magic dust to make all of these bottled waters taste the same.
The pixie dust is the packet of minerals that they put in to reinstitute the taste that they took out when they took out the minerals during the purification process.
Yes, that's right. But you have to understand, this stuff originates as potable tap water in the first place.
When you buy bottled water that's actually purified tap water as opposed to spring water, does it tell you that on the bottle? Does it say this water is actually from the Philadelphia water supply or the New Jersey municipal water plant?
There is no requirement at the federal level that water bottlers put the source of the water on their bottle. There has been some pressure in recent years to make them do that, and some of the big bottlers are beginning to list their sources. But there's no requirement. But if it doesn't say spring water, you can be pretty sure it's probably coming from some purified municipal water system. Interestingly, Poland Spring, which I think you mentioned earlier,
I didn't, but go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. is a Nestle brand. It's pretty well known on the East Coast. It's one of Nestle's many brands. But in the old days, Poland Spring came from Poland Spring, a spring in Maine that was known for its high-quality water. But the demand for bottled water from Nestle's and from Poland Spring has gotten so large that, in fact, there's almost no water coming out of Poland Spring anymore. They've overpumped it. And now Poland Spring water is no longer a source of water. It's a brand name. And the stuff that's in a Poland Spring water bottle may come from any one of half a dozen or more springs somewhere in the Northeast.
But it's still spring water. But you're saying that you think the name is misleading? That most people think it's actually the Poland Spring that they're getting the water from, not just the brand name now?
I would think that if I didn't know better. I would think that Poland Spring water would come from that famous Poland Spring.
Well, actually, there was a class action suit that you write about in your book in 2003 that accused the company of false advertising. What was the outcome?
Well, that's right. Yeah, when the news sort of started to filter out that, in fact, Poland Spring water no longer came from Poland Spring, I think some consumer groups in Connecticut and Massachusetts sued Nestle. And now, if you look carefully at the fine print on a Poland Spring bottle, you'll see it says, this water comes, and I don't have one in front of me, but this water comes from, and it lists 6 or 7 or 8 different springs. They do list Poland Spring as one of the many springs, without specifying actually where it comes from.
As you point out in your book, when you buy bottled water, you're unlikely to find out exactly where the water has come from, but you are going to learn that the water has 0 calories, 0 carbs, 0 protein, which you kind of already knew. So why don't you explain that labeling issue, that you don't have to tell where it's bottled, but you do have to say that it's got 0 calories?
I think bottled water labels are remarkable for how little information they really provide the consumer. They have a name, they have a company, they have often a beautiful logo of a mountain or some pristine natural scene.
Nice bird flying by.
And sometimes they have the FDA nutrition label that we're all familiar with from the back of our food products that tell us calories, fat, cholesterol, carbohydrates, protein, that kind of thing. And for bottled water especially, that label is just ridiculous. There is no fat. There's no cholesterol. There's no carbohydrates. There's no protein. There are no calories in bottled water. And so you look at a nutrition label for bottled water, and it's 0000. But there are things in water. There are always natural minerals in water. And in fact, we don't want to drink water that doesn't have natural minerals in it. There's calcium and iron and magnesium and potassium and sodium and zinc. And, there are all sorts of natural things that are perfectly healthy for us. But our labels in the United States don't tell us what really is in our bottled water.
So who decides what needs to be on the label? What agency is regulating that?
Bottled water in the United States is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. They determine the rules for labels. They determine the rules for water quality testing and monitoring. They determine inspection routines. It's odd that in the United States, where our tap water is regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency under the rules set by our law called the Safe Drinking Water Act, that bottled water is actually considered a food product. It's different and hence regulated by the FDA.
So that's interesting. So if you have 2 glasses and you pour bottled water into 1 glass and tap water into the other glass, both glasses are regulated by different agencies.
And the rules are different, and the monitoring, what they measure is different, and who does the measuring is different, and how often it's measured is different, and the rules for notifying the public about problems are different. I think this is one of the big problems with bottled water. I can't come up with a good argument why they shouldn't be identical, why the rules for tap water and bottled water shouldn't be the same, but they aren't.
So what are some of the differences in how tap water and bottled water are regulated?
Well, there are lots of differences. One of the big ones is that, first of all, the EPA regulates all of our tap water under federal law. The FDA regulates bottled water, but only bottled water that is in what we call interstate commerce, that crosses state lines. And so if somebody bottles water and sells it within the same state, the FDA doesn't have any regulatory authority over that to begin with. And so right off the bat, 60 to 70% of our bottled water actually isn't regulated by the federal government because it doesn't enter interstate commerce. But then the kinds of things that we measure are sometimes a little different. The rules are supposed to be the same. They're supposed to be no less protective than federal rules for tap water. But we often monitor tap water dozens of times a day. A big city will do water quality tests dozens of times a day. Bottled water might be tested once a week and once a month or once a year or even less often for certain kinds of constituents. It's often measured by laboratories that aren't independent. The companies often do their own bottled water testing, and they're supposed to report to the FDA, but they rarely do. There are a lot of differences.
One of the things you did as research for this book is you filed a Freedom of Information Act. What were you looking for? What did you ask for?
There is this question about how good our bottled water quality really is, and I believe mostly it's fine, but I also believe that we don't test and measure and report bottled water quality as much as we ought to. And one of the things that I wanted to try and find out was the extent to which the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is really keeping track of problems with bottled water. One day I heard about a recall of a brand of bottled water, and that made me think, all right, have there been other recalls of bottled water? And when I went to the FDA website, where in theory they're supposed to list food recalls, and I looked around for bottled water recalls, I found a few, but I didn't find the one that I knew about. And so I wrote to the FDA and said, look, I'd like to know all of the bottled water recalls that you've had. And it took months of back and forth before they finally released all of that information. But it turns out we do have problems with bottled water. There have been more than 100 official recalls of bottled water, many of which have never been – that aren't publicly available. There's been contamination with mold and with kerosene and with algae, and bottled water has been found with yeast and fecal coliforms and other bacteria and glass particles, and probably in my favorite example, with crickets. There was an instance in the mid-1990s with a bottler in Nacogdoches, Texas, where they produced bottled water with crickets, and they ended up recalling the water very late, months after the contamination was found, and probably months after those crickets were sold.
Were the crickets actually in the bottles?
Apparently. I didn't buy one, but there were crickets, or not to be too graphic, maybe cricket parts, in some of the bottled water that they bottled and sold.
So what's your conclusion based on the FOI information that you got?
Well, there are a couple of things that I think are worrisome. One is when we really do look at the quality of bottled water, we find problems. That's bad. It suggests we need to be much more aggressive about regulating and protecting bottled water quality and all water quality. Another one is that the rules aren't working right. I think the public ought to know more regularly, more frequently, more openly about what's in our bottled water. With these recalls, often the recalls themselves were not issued until literally months after the contamination was found and months after the product hit the shelves and probably was bought and consumed. When we have a contamination problem with our tap water, the rules say the public needs to be notified the same day. But with bottled water, the rules are much less strict.
So one of the problems that you have and that many people have with bottled water is that it creates and wastes all this plastic. You have, you know, a gazillion water bottles that are thrown out every day, and many of them are not recycled. So what happens to the not recycled plastic bottles?
In the United States, probably 70 or 75% of the plastic water bottles that we buy and consume are never recycled. The industry likes to tell us that PET plastic is completely recyclable, and that's true. But there's a big difference between recyclable and recycled. And the truth is, we're bad at recycling. We don't recycle most of the materials that we use that could be recycled. And the stuff that isn't recycled It goes to landfills. And when it goes to landfills, it's buried and it lasts forever, effectively forever. PET, because it's a wonderful food. It's a wonderful packaging for food, but it's wonderful because it's incredibly stable. And that characteristic makes it a bad thing for our landfills.
So what is PET plastic?
The vast majority of the bottled water that's sold in the United States is sold in something called PET, polyethylene terephthalate. It's the plastic with the little symbol number one for those people who look at the bottom of their plastic containers. And it was invented in the very early 1940s, in 1941, by two British chemists. And it's a wonderful plastic for food. It's resistant to heat. It's impermeable to carbonation, so we can put bubbly things in it. It's strong. It's light. It's impact resistant. It's transparent. And it's recyclable. It's a pretty good plastic for food products, but it's not so great for the environment.
So when you do recycle your bottles from bottled water, what happens to them then?
Well, it would be nice if we recycled our PET and we collected it and it was transported to someplace where they turned it back into bottles and closed the loop so that we didn't have to use raw petroleum, a very expensive material, to make new virgin PET. But that's not what happens. When we recycle our plastic, it typically goes, ironically enough, to China, where it's turned into fabric. It's turned into rugs. It's turned into strapping material. It's turned into polyester clothing. It's down what we call downcycled rather than recycled, really.
What's wrong with the recycling? Because isn't it preventing?
Oh, no. Yeah. No, recycling's great. I'm a big fan of recycling. I think 100% of our PET ought to be recycled. But I believe that the bottles that we make ought to be made from recycled material rather than from virgin petroleum, from raw resources. If we could close the loop, if we could recycle all our plastic bottles and turn them back into plastic bottles, first of all, we wouldn't have the environmental impact dealing. We wouldn't have to deal with huge quantities of plastic in landfill. And then we wouldn't have to take tremendous amounts of raw energy, petroleum, and turn it into stuff that we throw away.
So I'm still trying to wrap my mind around the fact that a lot of America's recycled plastic water bottles go to China for their recycling.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing, in part because there's not much demand for recycled material here in the United States. Coca-Cola's actually just opened a new plant in South Carolina that is going to turn recycled plastic bottles back into plastic bottles, or they're going to use some of that material for plastic bottles. But it's one of the weird things about the world economy today that it's economic to collect recycled plastic in the United States and then ship it across the Pacific, which is a really big ocean, to China, where they turn it into toys and carpets and other things that they then ship back to us. It's a strange... We live in a strange world economically when that sort of thing is practical.
You know, I think one of the concerns with tap water is that long after the water system, the municipal water systems were built, new chemicals were dumped into lakes and rivers and so on. And so that there's all kinds of pollutants in the water that our system was never designed to filter out, and that the EPA doesn't necessarily even test for. So in that sense, you don't know what you're drinking.
There's no doubt that our tap water system, which is good, could be better and should be better. The federal government should reassess the Safe Drinking Water Act, the law that determines the kinds of things that we measure and the kinds of things we monitor and protect in our tap water system, precisely because there are new things in the environment. There are new chemicals. There are better testing methods that let us detect smaller and smaller quantities of things. There are more and more things in our tap water system that might be bad for human health, and we ought to know whether they're bad, and we ought to remove them. And that requires, I think, supporting and expanding state-of-the-art tap water systems. Our tap water is not as good as it could be. It's good, but it ought to be better. And one of the reasons people move to bottled water is because they either are afraid that our tap water system isn't good enough or it isn't. And it ought to be fixed. The answer to the problems with our tap water isn't bottled water, though. We can't afford bottled water for everybody, and I think it would be a big mistake to let our tap water systems decay.
Well, Peter Glick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Peter Glick is the author of the new book, Bottled and Sold, The Story Behind Our Obsession with Bottled Water. He's the co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hank Jones, the musician Whitney Balliett said was widely regarded as the dean of jazz pianists, died yesterday at the age of 91. Jones and his two brothers became one of the most remarkable families in jazz history. Elvin Jones played with John Coltrane and became one of the most influential jazz drummers. Thad Jones played trumpet and co-led one of the most important big bands in the post-big band era. Hank Jones was the oldest of the brothers, and he lived longer than they did. He was the first to leave home. He toured with Jazz at the Philharmonic, recorded with Charlie Parker, accompanied Ella Fitzgerald, and worked for many years as a house pianist at CBS. He recorded many albums as a sideman and a leader. We're going to listen back to an interview I recorded with Hank Jones in 2005. Let's start with his 1987 recording of "Swonderful," featuring Eddie Gomez on bass and Jimmy Cobb on drums. Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. We're so glad to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure being here.
Let me start with what I know is a very obvious question, and it's probably the question you've been most asked about your career, which is, what do you think is the explanation for the fact that you and your late brothers Elvin and Thad Jones became such great musicians? I mean, was there something in your water? Was there something in your house, in your family? What do you think explains it?
Well, the only thing in the water were parasites. But I think the fact that both my mother and my father were musical had a lot to do with it, you know. And we come from a very religious background. Both my mother and my father were very religious. My father was a devout Christian all of his life. And he taught us the moral values, I think, is something that some parents don't teach their children. We learned more. I learned that early on. And my father, for instance, wouldn't even allow a pack of cards to be in the house. He was against gambling, drinking, smoking, you name it. He was, you know, he was a very, very devout Christian. And I think that had something to do with it. See, my father's main thing was that he didn't object to music per se, but he thought that no jazz should ever be played in the church. And he thought that if you had any kind of musical talent, it should be then exhibited in the church in the form of accompanying choirs or playing church music and so forth. But never any jazz in the church, and never played on Sunday, by the way.
Did you play in the church?
Yes, I played. I accompanied the church, the junior choir and the senior choir, both on organ and piano. And later, many, many years later, I actually played a jazz concert in a church in Tenafly, New Jersey. And the audience loved it. In fact, they invited us to do it over again. But I felt somewhat guilty, and I just didn't want to do it again. I thought that my father might not have approved.
What are some of the things you think you learned about the piano and about harmony and rhythm from playing in the church accompanying the choirs?
Well, all of the church hymns that were played and sung, some of which were written by Martin Luther, were all harmonically correct. And I think that some of that carried over into my my musical thinking, the phrases and the not the melodies particularly, but the way the hymns were phrased and the harmony that was used, I'm sure, carried over into my musical thinking.
How old were you when you went to New York to play in 43 or 44?
I was 21. Mm-hmm.
And so you were performing, I think, on 52nd Street or near 52nd Street, which was really quite a music scene in that period. Who were some of the other musicians who were playing near where you were playing?
Well, right across the street was a club called the Three Deuces. I was working with Hot Lips Page, Oran Hot Lips Page, at a place called the Onyx Club. And right across the street on 52nd Street was a club called the Three Deuces. Well, over there you had Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, Bud Powell, sometimes Al Haig, sometimes Stan Levy on drums. And they were all about the same age. Dizzy was a little older. Dizzy Gillespie, that is, had a big band about that time, and the big band had broken up into a small group, and the small group was playing at the Three Deuces. They were playing this new style of music called bebop, a term that I have never been really happy with, but I guess it described the music pretty much, but not accurately. Anyway, this is the kind of the style of music these people were playing. I was attracted by it. I thought it was an advance over what I'd been hearing previously to that time. So I unconsciously, perhaps, or maybe consciously, began to adapt some of this style into my own style of playing, which was basically a two-handed style, perhaps in the style of Teddy Wilson, Fats Waller at the time.
Did you go through a period of frustration in which you were trying to adapt your style to this new bebop sound? And I mean, was there a period when you couldn't quite figure out how to get it?
It meant that I had to listen to these things repeatedly over time, perhaps night after night, as long as I could, because, you see, between the sets that I played at the Onyx Club and the sets that the other club was playing across the street, there was maybe 20 minutes between. So I had to go over and listen in 20 minutes as hard as I could for several times during the night. And that way, at the end of the night, I'd have a pretty good idea of what was going on. I still couldn't play it, because I was still absorbing this style in my mind, you know. It took quite a while. It didn't happen overnight. And I still haven't mastered it yet.
Let's hear a recording that you made with Charlie Parker, and this is from 1952. We'll hear the song as you, and it features you, Parker, and Max Roach on drums. We heard my guest Hank Jones at the piano with Charlie Parker. So, Hank Jones, when you were starting to record and when you moved to New York, how old were your brothers Elvin and Thad, and at what stage in their musical development were they?
Well, Elvin and Thad were both up in Detroit at the time I came to New York, and they were working at a club called the Bluebird, I think it was on Grand River Avenue. And they were working with musicians, the likes of J.J. Johnson, Sonny Stitt, maybe even at times Charlie Parker, and people like that, who came through Detroit to play. And Bluebird was the club to play at because it was one of the best-known, probably the best-known jazz club in Detroit at the time. And they were the house band there. So they had to play with all these people that came through to play at the club. So by the time they got to New York, they were already fairly familiar with the New York jazz scene, having heard these people in Detroit, you see.
As the older brother, what kind of advice or help did you try to give them when they were young?
Well, I guess I told them the same things that my father tried to tell me, you know, stay clear of all of these vicious habits that people get into, that their health, that deprive you of your health, eventually probably your life as well. And this is what happened to some of the younger musicians who came to New York and fell into that kind of thing. Probably they weren't able to see if they had been able to resist that first attempt or that first trial, they might have steered clear of it. But a lot of them couldn't resist. They wanted to try something new. So by the time they tried something new, it got to be a habit. And when it became a habit, they were slaves to the habit, and it took them down. This happened to a few young players, unfortunately. But I tried to tell Thad Nevin about things like this because I'd seen it happen. Mm-hmm. And I had managed to steer clear of it myself because I had no desire to go that route. So I guess they listened, at least partially. And it probably helped them. At least I hope it did.
I believe while you were in New York that Art Tatum became something of a mentor to you. How well did you know him? What was your relationship to him?
I had met Art when he was playing in Buffalo. When I was playing at the Anchor Bar across town in Buffalo, there was a place called McVan's, another nightclub. And Art used to play there periodically during the year and a half I spent in Buffalo. And whenever he would come into town to play, after our last set at the Anchor Bar, we'd go over and catch his last set. And I got to hear a lot of Art Tatum in Buffalo. After Art finished playing at McVan's, he would often go to a restaurant down in Midtown or somebody's home. Somebody would invite him to come to his home to play. And he would play until the early hours of the morning. Let's say maybe the late hours, maybe 11 or 12 o'clock the next day. That's how he played. He liked to play like that. This happened almost every time I heard him play there. And he would invariably have a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. Maybe I shouldn't mention that. But anyway, he'd have a case of... Too late. He mentioned this. He would always have a bottle of beer in his hand, or not when he was playing, of course, but after he finished playing. But he liked to drink beer at that time.
So what was your relationship with him?
I had met him, and of course I was fascinated. I was enthralled. I couldn't believe it. I look at him and I say, it's impossible to do what he's doing. But I'm sitting there and I'm looking at him and I'm watching him do it, and I still don't believe it. It was almost magic. It was really magic. The things that he could do on the piano and right up until his demise, he was fantastic. He was undoubtedly the true genius that you hear the name flouted around so much. Art Tatum was a true genius.
Now, I know you met Thelonious Monk. I don't know how close you ever got to him. But when you first heard his playing, did it sound wrong to you? You know, because he was playing dissonances that most people would have thought of as mistakes. And yep. He was playing these kind of like erratic rhythms that didn't fit the predictable rhythm patterns that people were playing. So did you get it right away, or did it sound wrong to you?
Well, it never sounded wrong to me. It sounded different. And even the dissonances that he played, they were intentional, you know. So to me, it sounded like, okay, he wanted to prove something musically, and this was the only way to do it. If you played conventional harmony at that point, it wouldn't have had the impact. So he used the dissonance to emphasize what he was doing.
What impact did it have on you to hear him?
Well, it left a very, very... I was in awe of what he was doing, because I had never heard anybody who thought musically that in that way. Use intentional dissonances. Oh, some composers have used it, but not to the extent that Monk used it. Monk used it on every composition that he played. If he played Body and Soul or any ballad, you could tell immediately that it was Monk, because his stamp was on it. the way he voiced his chords, his choice of chords, his choice of harmonic patterns, and so forth. This was distinctively wrong. He was a stylist. He was an individual with a style that was just almost impossible to imitate.
Now, from 1959 to 76, you worked as a staff pianist for CBS television and radio. The shows that you played for included The Ed Sullivan Show. What else?
Gary Moore Show, Jackie Gleason, and two radio shows, and some television shows that didn't make it. And also, there was a television show called American Musical Theater. Well, I conducted that show a couple of times, you know. But they played mostly classical music on that show. But the other shows, the Ed Sullivan Show, the Jackie Gleason Show, and the Gary Moore Show were variety shows. That is, they had comedians, they had dancers, they had singers, they had dog acts, sometimes elephant acts, and so forth. You know?
Oh, yeah, people juggling plates and all of that.
Exactly.
So you had to play for the elephant acts and the people juggling plates and walking the tightrope and for Ella Fitzgerald, probably. And
yeah.
Was that fun?
It was, but it was interesting, you know, because from week to week, you never knew quite what you were going to have to do that particular week. You found out during the rehearsals, but sometimes things happened during the show that didn't happen at the rehearsal. Sometimes you had to improvise something might go wrong during a live show. See, if it happened during a tape show, you can always stop the tape. But if it happened during a live show, you have to improvise as you go along.
You did a lot of session work, too. Did you record on any records that became big hits, but nobody really knows that you were the pianist on the record?
I don't believe so. Not often. I've done some things with Ella Fitzgerald that almost everything she did was a hit,
yeah,
hit record. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I recorded quite a bit with her. Also, I was lucky enough to work with Marilyn Monroe. Now, ordinarily, she's not considered to be a singer, but she did sing very well.
She was primarily
an actress. I had the occasion of playing for her when she sang Happy Birthday and Thanks for the Memories for President Kennedy.
That was you at the piano?
That's right, yes. And I tell you, she did 16 bars, 8 bars of Happy Birthday to You and 8 bars of Thanks for the Memories. So in 16 bars, we rehearsed 8 hours. So I think that's something like a half hour per bar of music, you know. She was very nervous and upset. She wasn't used to that kind of thing. And I guess who wouldn't be nervous singing Happy Birthday to the president?
Right.
And she got through it very well, I think. But it was a very trying experience.
Okay, well, we have this on CD, so let's hear it. Marilyn Monroe with my guest Hank Jones at the piano, singing to the president.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Marilyn Monroe serenading the president with my guest Hank Jones at the piano. Hank Jones, you know, we were talking about how you played at CBS for many years and did a lot of studio work. What was your reaction to John Coltrane's music when your brother Elvin Jones was the drummer with Coltrane? And you know, Coltrane had been doing a lot of pretty far out experimentation, playing very free.
Yes.
Did you relate to that?
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't relate to it very well. It was an approach that I had heard, but I had sort of rejected because I had been listening. You have to understand. I had been listening to people like Lester Young, Chu Berry, Coleman Hawkins, Charlie Parker, and this was quite a field from what John Coltrane was doing. And I understood what he was doing, but I just didn't agree with it musically at the time. Later, I began to accept it. I think more, and of course, Elvin, my brother, was with the band, so I had another reason for listening to it more carefully, you know, and it began to make more sense to me as time went on. And I think it took a little bit of time for me to get used to it.
You didn't record a lot with your brothers, but what was it like when you did play with them, with Elvin and Thad Jones? Was there any kind of special connection? I mean, you were older than they were, so I don't know if you played together much as kids.
Well, we didn't play much, very much as kids. Because remember, I left the Pontiac scene and the Michigan scene years before they did, maybe 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been in New York for almost 10 years before Thad and Elvin came. Although, you know, when I first got to New York, I mentioned their names to people like Leonard Feather and some others, and they were included in Leonard Feather's, one of his books. Their names were in his book long before they got to New York, you know. But they were not strangers when they arrived there. And of course, they had already played with some of these people who had come through Detroit and played at the Bluebird. But we didn't play together because we just were not in the same place at the same time. And our musical tastes differed somewhat, but in many ways they were very similar. But it was just a question of being in the same place at the same time. And we just, unfortunately, we're not. We did two things together, two record dates. And, of course, I played down at the Village Vanguard for a time with the Thad Jones and Mel Lewis band. And I had to cut that short because it didn't coincide with my CBS schedule. I couldn't stay up all night and then work all day at CBS, so I had to give it up. But we didn't play together as often as I'd like to have, and that's unfortunate because now it's impossible. But
did you feel like there was any kind of special connection when you did play together?
Yes, I did. I thought there was. There was always something special. And that's one of the reasons I regret that we didn't do more of it. I'm truly sorry about that.
The jazz critic Whitney Balliot, who's quite a fan, as you know, of your playing, once wrote, "Jones's solos think." And then you once told Whitney Balliot, "Concentration is the difference between the great players and the players who are not great." Do you think when you're soloing?
Well, yes, you do. You know, but your thoughts are running ahead. Let's see, if you can separate your thoughts from your actions, they're tied together, of course. But your thoughts are ahead of what you actually do. Because by the time you get to the place, your thoughts are maybe four or five bars ahead of where you actually are physically at the piano. So by the time you get there, you've already played what you thought like 4 seconds, 5 seconds before that, you see. In other words, you're thinking ahead. So, yes, you're concentrating and you're thinking.
You know, a lot of people might think, oh, it's just intuitive.
I think that plays a part of it, but it's certainly not the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know what you're doing. In order to know what you're doing, you have to think about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to know the music that you're playing. You have to know the tune that you're playing. You have to know what the chord progressions are. And then, okay, now the improvisations are intuitive. Of course, the intuition is based on prior knowledge, isn't it? I mean, how can you be intuitive if you don't have some prior knowledge of what you're doing? So the prior knowledge always comes into play there. You must have thought of it before that.
As you approach your 87th birthday, does it surprise you that you've, outlived for years your younger brothers, Elvin and Thad?
Well, I don't know. I tell you, it's certainly disheartening. I don't know. I don't know whether I should feel surprised or not. I've always lived my life a certain way. I don't know. Perhaps my lifestyle had something to do with my longevity. Hopefully it did. But, you know, nobody lives forever, of course. And maybe it was just their time. It is not my time yet, you know. I intend to go on until I'm 250. I'm working on that now, actively. I hope to play better than I played the last time. That's my objective, to always do better, to reach another level.
Does that mean you're still practicing? I mean, do you still, like, practice at
home? Of course, yes. I don't see anybody can do without practicing, you know.
So what do you do when you practice now?
I do scales, exercises, and I try to learn new material and review old material. You see, I try to be conversant with the piano. You have to be on good speaking terms with the piano, or the piano will rebuff you. I've heard the piano described as a man-eating monster with black and white teeth, and it's true.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Pianist Hank Jones, recorded in 2005. He died yesterday at the age of 91. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.